Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. I had one last Pot D podcast in me before we turn things over to Maester Anthony and he continues his chapter by chapter review discussion book club of the Game of Thrones series. He's going to be doing a Clash of Kings coming up next. I had one more Hot D podcast, and this is going to be Jim is not in the room. It's going to be between two book readers, two co-host book readers of a podcast where the other person doesn't read the books. I thought it'd be interesting to bring on, get her experience. She's one of the sharpest Game of Thrones commentators I know. She's Kim Renfro. She's an entertainment reporter for Insider, a co-host on Cast of Kings, the Fabulous House of Dragon podcast with David Chin. You can follow her on Twitter at Kim R. Renfro. All those will be mentioned in the show notes, so you can be sure to follow everything that she's doing online. Very excited to have her on the podcast. So welcome back, I should say, to the podcast, Kim.
Yeah, thank you. It's been too long.
I've listened to a lot of you and David's conversations. You guys are one of the first to the market podcast, and I listen to a lot of podcasts that come out before mine. After mine comes out, then I'm like, I don't care anymore. But like, so you guys had some market leader positions. It sounds like you had a really good time. You guys had a really good time covering the first season.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know what to expect, but both the show itself and the experience of actually regularly podcasting were both really overall positive, which is awesome.
You mentioned on your, I can't remember if it's the one for episode 10 or the wrap up podcast, that like, you know, there was a little bit extra juice of the last few seasons of Game of Thrones. You expressed weren't as fun or didn't feel as fun, or maybe it was more draining to cover. And that's certainly something I identified with. But like you had mentioned that like this hot, you felt like kind of like really loose and fresh coming out of Hot D season, which I also identified with. What the disparity?
Maybe it's just my antidepressants.
Yeah, some chemical help this time around.
I have a therapist and a psychiatrist now.
I see.
Honestly, maybe I've just done a lot of good introspecting over the last few years about what I allow to define my self-worth, or like how good of a time I'm having with something that's like work-related. You know, and I think that I had a much healthier relationship to covering House of the Dragon than I did with Game of Thrones. But also, I just think like it felt like a reset in some ways. You know, it's a season one. We're no longer dealing with the, oh God, we're off the books BS. Oh God, are all these fan theories going to come true? Like when I first started covering Game of Thrones, I just liked being the person who was sort of like an intermediary between book readers and show watchers, and kind of like adding context to things or outlining fan theories that I felt pretty confident might come true, and like fun stuff. And then once we got off the book path, it just turned into like a much more intense game of like, am I going to guess exactly what happens right? Or am I going to watch this leaked episode and then like trash what, like it just, it got all messy. And I feel like House of the Dragon, just by nature of the type of adaptation that it was, had none of that chaos attached to it, which was really nice to have a break from.
Yeah, I've been trying to figure out what that is. I know that the last couple seasons, you might be onto something about it not going off book, and why this is so chill, because everything is like finished. There isn't any like, guess what they're going to do, because broad strokes, we pretty much know. And I could that that pressure off probably helps out a lot. The other thing is, I just felt like that for like especially season 7 and 8, I felt like there's this growing sense that there was something that was not right or something that was kind of going wrong. And maybe it's because it literally was drifting off the books. And, you know, it seems like, you know, because like George was increasingly distant about how he's talking about the show. But it's like, and whereas everything just seems like so simpatico over on the Hot D side, like, you know, the book readers and the show watchers and George and Ryan Condal, and everybody's kind of on the same page about how we feel about everything and where everything's going. And it feels good.
Yeah. No, totally nailed it.
One of the things that I think you and I can, you know, like have like somewhat unique experience is we both host a podcast where we have a co-host that's kind of like, you know, doing the scene by scene recapping, and we're kind of the color commentators, and they have not read the books and we have read the books.
Mm-hmm.
How fun is it to be the book reader on a non-book reader podcast?
It's pretty fun. I feel like it makes my job easier in some ways of like, oh, I just have to like wait for you to pose the question that other people in your situation might have of having not read the books or whatever, instead of me having to like guess what I think non-book readers might have questions about. Like,
how do you handle when David's like driving pretty far off the map? You know,
guesses?
Yeah, because my thing is like I established this thing like way back at the beginning of Game of Thrones podcast, where like any time that my co-host would speculate, I would, and it would be on something that's like on the future, I would just say, well, that's mildly interesting. And that way I practiced to where like, regardless of whether he was like saying, I think Robb Stark's going to die 3 episodes from now, or whether he was saying, I think Joffrey is going to become a necromancer warlock, I could just nail that inflection and I never gave anything away.
Yeah, David Chen told me that I had a pretty solid poker face, which was helpful, I guess. I guess I was good at that.
You just sit there and just nod and let him run.
I ask him questions back of like, oh, like, why do you think that?
Like, that's what I like to do. I like to
piecing together.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Or yeah, that. Like the one that's popping into mind now is like in the pilot episode when me and Dave were talking about the throne room scene between Rhaenyra and Daemon. And he was like, weird vibes here. Like, wasn't really sure what was going on, but it sort of seems like they're setting up that like the main conflict is going to be between Rhaenyra and Daemon, like fighting for the throne. And I was like, yeah, there were a lot of things happening in that scene. Mm-hmm. Like, weird vibes for sure. Let's see where they go with that. Because in my head, I'm like, not only is that not the main conflict of the show, but also the vibes that you're picking up on are incest vibes.
Right.
But I also don't want to tell you that yet. So yeah, just sort of poker facing my way through. Letting
you find yourself have to... Do you have to find yourself ever like consciously remembering to not like lead the witness, or is that pretty easy for you to like avoid that temptation?
I think it's pretty easy for me to avoid. I have a couple of close friends who I love talking about like all forms of media with, and one of them is like very, very spoiler phobic. Like, gets very upset if I even like say like, oh, have you seen that movie? It was so good. Like, she doesn't even want to know if I thought the movie was good or not. If she
right, because that taints her the reaction. Yeah.
Right. So I think that I'm just naturally practiced at like keeping my spoiler thoughts in my head until the conversation seems okay for me to like go that far. So yeah, I have my book reader friends who I do get to talk about like all the spoilerific stuff with, which helps too. So yeah, no, I just I enjoyed seeing David Chen in his spoiler free bubble. And then when he, in one of our bonus episodes, he asked me to spoil what was coming in the finale. And I was like,
what are you doing? Yeah.
I was like, I'm really worried that you're going to like regret having asked me that if I tell you something, but he didn't mind. So
We're on the subject of spoilers, and I got to say the one thing that I was always pretty proud of the Game of Thrones community, the book readers versus the show watchers, is there was, I think, a kind of fiduciary duty assumed by the book readers to not, like, spoil the people who are watching the show, to save those surprises for people, like, they got the surprise in the book. I thought that broke down some in the later seasons because, you know, it's like, oh, it's a leaked episode, yeah, and it's kind of like fair game for anybody. And then there is, you know, in the very end, there's just like a lot of troll spoilers. Do you think that it's going to be possible for us as a community to avoid spoilers? Because what I've seen a lot of people who they're rediscovering Game of Thrones, the series, because it's like safe to go back and explore that now because you've got, you know, new material, and they're getting to like season 3, episode 4, and Joffrey's giving Margaery a little tour of the Great Sept, and he's dropping some interesting Targaryen history, and oh my God, spoilers for maybe the end. You don't know. Maybe the mid, spoilers for House of the Dragon. Since and I think part of the reason it was easy for book readers not to spoil non-book readers is because us book readers to a large extent also didn't know where the hell things were going. So right. It's like you could drop it, but you don't really know who's going to sit the Iron Throne at the end. We have all the answers, and it doesn't seem like Ryan Condal is going to zig or zag just for shock value or for to subvert our reader expectation. Do you think it's something that we can, for 3 or 4 seasons, like, keep to ourselves? Do you think that it's just going to be because of Game of Thrones, because of the novels, because of Fire and Blood, it's going to be impossible to keep these things under wraps?
I don't think it's impossible if everybody operates from the same intention of wanting to preserve the biggest dramas of the Dance with Dragons. For show watchers, my concern is that I don't know how many people are thinking about that or who are deciding to honor that. Because yeah, in retrospect, with like the Red Wedding, it was crazy. Impressive. The yes. length to which book readers went to preserve that. Like, not even typing out the words Red Wedding. It was just referred to as RW if it needed to be mentioned at all. So that people wouldn't even have their eye out for a wedding that was going to be dramatic, you know? Like,
that's how it did get spoiled for me. And that's when I decided to go ahead and start reading the books, as I saw a naked reference to Red Wedding. And I was far enough along in the books that I'm like, oh, right.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, I appreciated that for other people.
the thing that I was sort of side-eyeing on Twitter this season was like the like pre-episode photos or just other quotes and context and stuff, and like people posting like out of context, but like, here's a really sweet picture of Rhaenyra and her boys. This is going to be so sad. And I'm like, why are you even letting people know that like something to do with those two characters is like a big deal?
I thought some of the fan accounts, especially some of the quote fan accounts, got a little too cute on the second half of the season, because like, again, I've read them all. So I didn't, you know, I knew exactly. But I'm like, you're posting the evenings leading up to the night, like stuff that's I would consider pretty big spoilers with textual images of the next time ons, which that's the other thing is like. If you're serious about not being spoiled for next episode, I wouldn't. I thought there was some definite like things that would have diminished my value if my first watch value if I was going into the episode. But maybe that's because I was a book reader and I knew, because that's the thing. Every time I see a next time on as a book reader, I'm like, oh my Christ, I just know everything's going to happen now. Right. But out of context, maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the sort of winking at the people who know what's going to happen out in the open like that is, I would discourage that, because I do think that it's like, I don't think that that's fair play in terms of like people who want to avoid spoilers. They're not going to know that they need to like mute
Yes.
your account because you're posting pre-show, like, you know.
Yeah, and it's like, I was following somebody's guy, and I thought they were doing like, well, after the episode airs, here's the you know, like, here's how it actually happened on page. So it's kind of like an appreciation, and then not, and then it kind of got a little spoilery at the end, but yeah. And also the thing that is, if everyone could do that perfectly, do the wink, you know, it's like you got two kids in front of you or your dog and you're spelling out P-A-R-K and W-A-L-K because you don't like, you're, you know, like, that's fine. But then I feel like some of these people are, they're, you're not the 30-year-old mom and you're dealing with a 3-year-old kid. You're a 30-year-old mom and you're dealing with a 35-year-old that can, that knows all the words that you're typing. It's like, it's not that clever. It's not that hidden. It's not that veiled. And it's going to spoil people.
Right. It's a little too obvious for a conversation that should be spoiler free for show watchers, which, like, that was something that I asked Ryan Condal about in the preseason interview that I did, was like, what's your expectation for the spoiler etiquette? And he was basically like, my hope is that it's the same as it was for Game of Thrones. And I don't know so far that we've squared to that. I think people are being a little more liberal than they were in the early seasons. Like, to me, that's the equivalent of like taking that Jon Snow, Ned Stark goodbye scene and like adding a bunch of like quotes and being like, well, we know, wink wink, who his mom is. And it's like, hey, if you're watching the show for the first time, you have no idea that that's like the biggest fan theory in the books or anything, you know, like,
right.
So I don't know, I think people could be a little more cautious about it, but I'm not a Twitter cop, so do whatever.
You don't have a badge or a gun or nothing.
No, my blue check mark.
It just seems like, it's just like, you know, I definitely felt like the surge in pressure building up as Hot D kind of rolled onto the market. Like, you know, it's like, oh, this is big television again. Like, everyone on Twitter is memeing at the same time. And there is such a huge pressure to be first and to get the most eyeballs and the most retweets that I feel like there is this... you know, it's such a big machine now, and it's coming back at the infancy of Hot D. I feel like that there is like a perverse incentive here to like go as close as you can to spoilers to tantalize the non-readers, and like, you know, because I've proven this to my satisfaction. Given a choice, if a fan can choose moderation and not engaging in seeing a spoiler, or like giving in to the temptation and indulging in spoilers and then ruining it for themselves, 9 times out of 10, they'll do the latter. You know, it seems like spoilers burn a hole in people's mental pocket. And if like they know they're there and they can seek them out. So it's like, man, that's the thing I worry about. You got a perverse incentive for the content creators to skirt that line. And you got a perverse incentive from the fans that they just want to know everything, even if it's like to their detriment.
Yeah, I definitely saw, I mean, the full episode leak in like, you know, 1080 HP. D or whatever, the weekend before the finale was like when I was like, oh, okay, we're back. We're like, we're fully in Game of Thrones mode again with the demand for knowing what happens next in this show.
Yeah.
Which was a dangerous game that people were playing with seasons, what, 6 through 8?
I know that they started leaking full episodes in 7. I don't know that happened in 6. Maybe it did, but like, it got really ridiculous at 7.
5 was when all 4 episodes that were sent as DVDs.
Oh, really?
All 4 episodes leaked before the season had even begun. So that was one. And then after that, press didn't get screeners anymore for any of the Game of Thrones.
And there were never any more leaks.
And then, the leak started coming from international.
Inside the house. Yeah, like translators for subtitles.
Right.
And
it was like
subtitle
translators
thousands and thousands of people touch hands on these things, just, you know, ingesting into the content system and translating and doing the subtitles and doing the credits. And it's just like, at some point.
But I also feel like even then, even when it was, you know, all bets are off in season 8 and full episodes were leaking on Sunday mornings or whatever, it still felt like the people who were seeking out those leaks were like relatively contained in like the Free Folk subreddit or in private chats or whatever. This time I was like, people are making GIFs of like the most surprising moments and circulating them on Twitter like it's nothing. And I was like, where'd the line where did that line go? Where it's like, yeah, maybe a screenshot. I remember like Viserion's eye, like Viserion getting reawoken by the Night King, like that still of his like blue eye kind of made the rounds on Twitter. But like, this was like, I don't like the entire like Luke and Aemon scene circulating in like, and so, yeah, I think that we might've lost the right way about things at some point, and maybe that's just the chaos of the internet building upon itself. But my preference would be if we go back to the days of like, you know, pursue leaks or don't, whatever it is, but like, that's your business.
Leave everybody else to do it.
Disseminating them in super public ways is the right etiquette for people who are genuinely just waiting until Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern time to find out what happens.
There's still lots of hot D to talk about. We'll be back right after the break.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans.
That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And now back to Hot D. Well, this is a related question. People have asked me all season long. Aaron, I am very curious about what happens next. Should I read Fire and Blood, the book in which House of the Dragon is based on? What would your answer be if someone said, hey, I'm super into this. I want to know more. Do you think I should? Would I be better off reading Fire and Blood, or would I be better off just chilling and waiting for the series to come out?
I think it depends on what you're hoping to find in Fire and Blood. Because for me, I watched the pilot episode of Game of Thrones before I had read the books. But like, same. That pilot episode was enough for me to be like, oh, I not only need to know what happens next, but like, I want to experience the story for myself, because it's like nuts, right? Mm-hmm. We have like a incest child murder happening. Like, sure. What the hell is going on? I need to know. And like, that I think was the right call for anyone who got into Game of Thrones through the show and wanted more. Like, there's so much more depth in those books compared to what can be reasonably translated onto screen. And you're in,
and
they're not just
lore dumps. They're also satisfying narrative thing experiences in their own right.
Right. You're in all the characters' heads and their point of views and all this stuff. So for Fire and Blood, I'm like, if what is interesting to you about this adaptation is the way that they're choosing to portray these events, like, to me, that has been the main like thrust of the whole season, is that Ryan Condal and Miguel Sapochnik, and I'm assuming with input from George, have decided to take a very specific point of view on the events in those books and retell them and sometimes change them to show the bias of these male historians in this fictional world and to show the bias of the patriarchy in general. And so like, if the reason why you want to read Fire and Blood is just to find out what happens next, like, I think that you can do that, although you're going to get a lot of confusing and conflicting accounts, and we're not sure yet which ones of those are going to super come true or not, or if there's going to be some twist on how they did, like we saw with Laenor's death being like a fake out that was conceived by Rhaenyra herself and like Daemon and stuff. So
that was impressive, the genuine amount of surprises for book readers. Like, maybe not like, you know, someone lived or someone died, although that literally happened in the case of Laenor, but the motivations. Like, honestly, I was not expecting the late game shock of like, oh, actually, Aemon didn't want to kill Luke. Or at least not here and there. I thought that was fascinating. So that's the thing, is like, a lot of those twists are not even in the original material, and it's just very dry and matter of fact in its storytelling.
Yeah.
It's not gripping.
I agree. I didn't even read the first half of the book when it first came out.
Did you really?
Me and you did podcast.
Oh, I didn't know you skipped off because, like, because I just, like, it was so hard. And that's the thing is, like, I didn't really have strong opinions on who was the right side, who was the good side, who was the bad side on the Dance of the Dragons when I read it in Fire and Blood. I have very strong feelings after watching the show.
Yeah.
You know,
I guess now that we're talking this through, I think that I find the show experience a lot more fun engaging with it that way. And like knowing generally what is coming next, but sitting there being very curious and engaged to find out how they're going to go about it, which account they're going to pick. Are they going to go with a third unwritten account from this book? So I think that that's fun, but I don't think that you should seek it out thinking that you're going to get like, oh, so much more time with my favorite character because I'm going to read what happens to them next. Like some of them,
like, I can't wait to see
three more sentences.
Yeah, I can't wait to see how Harwin and Rhaenyra's torrid love affair on the page where it can have room to breathe. Like, no, it won't. It won't. Oh, it's you got way more
for those.
Yeah. I want to talk about that. I thought it was fun to see George through Ryan Connell in this show experiment with some of what I feel are his new and evolving thoughts on Targaryens, on Valyrians, on dragon riding, on how they bond. Because I have a pretty good feeling that the way that George talks about the show is like these are all stuff that essentially he's either signed off on or were his original ideas. And it's stuff that like I don't think because he hasn't gotten to the point in the books where Dany really has to master her dragons and they have to fight and do all that kind of stuff. Like these are things that like he's not even set in stone and sure about. Do you think we'll see other forms of like George kind of testing, field testing ideas for his books through House of the Dragon and stuff like Fire and Blood? And do you think there's any connection to this between what I would call a torrid flood of updates about Winds of Winter of late coming out of his Not a Blog and of his media appearances and that like, that was a long, complicated question. Do you have thoughts?
I think that we probably will see, building on the sort of added dragon lore that we're already getting in this episode or in this first season. I think hopefully more about like all the castles and stuff. I think I appreciate that like Ryan Condal seems to be really keen on bringing things like heraldry and the designs of castles and like the layout of things to life in a specific way that I'm assuming George is happy with. Because I think that and all of the like I don't think that they're leaning too hard into it now, but I appreciate the inclusion of like the magic stuff like that all just sort of fell away in the later seasons of Game of Thrones, and I feel like George might have felt that absence of like, wait, there's so much more stuff with the Children of the Forest or like whatever that like I have in mind, and we just kind of it was a little bullet point and then we moved on and it didn't really factor into like a lot of the final stuff. And so I do think that it seems like he's having fun getting to have the input that he does on the little details that Ryan Condal is working in, whether it's how are dragon eggs laid? Like all of that. Like when Damon was like digging them up, I was like, wait a second. Now I have more questions about like, how did that
this is
clutch
a clutch? Oh, wow. Okay.
Get there. Yeah. And like all of the stuff with claiming dragons and the dragon seeds and like all of those little tidbits. I do think that I hope that we see more of them. And it does seem like, I mean, Lord knows what's going on with the Winds of Winter. I kind of maintain my usual line of like, I think that he's been trying to finish that book for 10 years and he has more productive years than doesn't. And I do think that I think that finally just having Game of Thrones end and be out there was like, all right, now I'm super not even racing the clock on like anything connected to this adaptation. Maybe that freed him up a little bit more with his like writer's block or with like,
see, I think doing Fire and Blood and doing House of Dragon has kind of like, to his satisfaction, kind of got like you know, it's like, well, I'm not getting, you know, it just seems like he's got this inescapable knot that he's tied up himself. He called it the Miranese knot. And I think he pushed it back a couple books. He never actually resolved it. Mm-hmm. And he was feeling no motivation to do that. So like going back, and clearly he has a lot of fun going back and thinking about these Targaryen kings and like, what is this guy like? And what is that guy like? And it's something he can just kind of screw around with, but also work out, you know, like how do dragons work? Cause like the way his gardener technique works, I think that he knows probably who sits on the Iron Throne and broad points how to get there. But like, he might really be like, gosh, do I want this horn to be the thing? Or do I want there to be some kind of blood magic that hinted at to be a thing? Or is it some kind of, he's like, you know, he's got these massive books and I feel like it's helped him out a lot. And I'm starting to feel a little bit more optimistic. The way he's been talking, like 75-80%, like that's a pretty high completion. I don't think he'd say that unless he's getting close. I'm starting to feel a little optimistic about wins.
Hey, welcome to the club.
Welcome back. Yeah, I was an optimist for a long time, and then I'm like, you know what? Probably never. But we'll see. I want to talk about the prophecy angle. This is something that that's what I really wanted to talk to you after we saw the pilot, because I really thought that I would be able to kick back my heels and just kind of chill out on the whole. There are not going to be a lot of connections to the main Game of Thrones. There's not going to be anything that's going to give any kind of red meat to like the new fan theories. It's just going to be like this kind of romp through Targaryen history, and then hit us up with the secret blade that reveals the message, that has the dream of Aegon the Conqueror, who all and I'm like, huh, okay, we'll see where this goes. I have to say, I'm not so sure that the prophecy angle actually added anything to the story, and I felt like in the late game of House of Dragon, it minorly detracted. These are all very like minor missteps. These are not major criticisms. But like, what's your opinion on that? Do you see like, you're like, oh yes, this prophecy really sharpened up the focus on blah this, or it really brought to head the conflict between this? What's your opinion, just again, one season in, about what they're doing with the Aegon Song of Ice and Fire prophecy?
Yeah, I honestly, once again, maybe my antidepressants talking. I could not get myself riled up very much.
I need you to cut back the meds and get worked up a little, Kim. Come on. We need some red meat
here. Tap into those emotions. No, it was like, I don't know. I think I agree with you that like it wasn't super additive. Aside, like the two primary reasons I can think for including it in the way that they did were just that Ryan Condal is a big fan of all of the A Song of Ice and Fire, all of George's writing. And he said that George just sort of like mentioned this in a conversation with him, like offhandedly. And I can, I can see myself being in that situation with George R. R. Martin and then being like, wait, what did you just say about Aegon's prophecy? Like this was a whole thing. And like feeling like that needs to be communicated to fans if possible, especially if like it's in this show somehow. And then Ryan Condal also said that the invented bit that him and Miguel Sapochnik landed on was like the idea that Viserys would be passing it along from like heir to heir. Like that, he said, was sort of their invention, but that the prophecy itself was true. So I can just see him like wanting to, like being excited to get to tell fans this like extra new nugget of information from George, even though they're in this weird position of having to like match Game of Thrones canon and match George's A Song of Ice and Fire canon, hopefully.
Which is not the same, probably in the final chapters,
maybe,
right?
But we don't know. Right. So I'm sitting here being like, I don't know. I feel like I can't confidently have an opinion on it until and there are so many unknowns between like how much House of the Dragon is quote unquote correcting some of the canon that was laid out in Game of Thrones, or maybe they're not, or maybe like they're just trying to find some middle ground between George's unpublished ending to the story and the details that they're including in their prequel that they thought book readers might be interested in. Like,
I do think it's interesting that Fire and Blood and even the World of Ice and Fire introduces this conflicting, no one really knows when it comes to history narrative into the Game of Thrones universe, the actual universe. Because like it does seem that like George is going to, if he does finish Winds and Dream, he's going to ask a legion of fans, hundreds of millions of fans, to like, OK, you heard one version, but now here's the real thing. And I wonder if he's like, you know, like this is an intentional kind of like introducing these ideas in their head because he knows he's going to have to come and at some point like kind of retcon things. And then from Connell's perspective, this makes a lot of sense if like HBO is like, we need something that kind of ties everything together. And we're going to have this Valyrian steel knife and this prophecy kind of like unite the larger Game of Thrones cinematic universe so that every single show that we have come out of the thing's going to tie together the Targaryen anthology or whatever. It's going to be this blade, this prophecy, and you know, the Jon Snow sequel's going to like maybe bend canon back to where George wants it to be, and then eventually he'll write. I don't know. That's the thing. Cause I think it's like, okay, maybe it added a little here, maybe it subtracted. The thing that really bugged me is Alicent misunderstanding the prophecy at the end. I felt like they laid such elegant tracks of just having that just to be an emotional human thing where like just when her and Rhaenyra get to a good spot, the king dies and maybe she wants to spare Rhaenyra, but her dad's there calling her a fool and saying, this is the moment we've been waiting for. And now you're going to crap out because of one bad dinner, but no, it's this whispered king. I don't know. But if it ties together the whole series, like if you 10 years from now, like, you know, the one thing that kind of like runs through this like a river is this knife and this prophecy. And it always add a little spice because you never knew who knew. I think that's the one thing that I'm fascinated by is who knows. Like Rhaenys was a Rhaenys, I'm sorry, as I call her. Does she know? Because she was the presumptive heir for a long time. No,
he says. Never? So he says. I of course copied and pasted out my transcription of that first pilot episode conversation, but he says this secret, it's been passed from king to heir. But I'm assuming that Viserys only found out after he was named heir, and then Jaehaerys told him, and then Viserys didn't tell anybody else until he like truly landed on Rhaenyra being his heir. And again, that like adds to the drama of why Daemon behaved the way that he did in the finale, because like that response was him being infuriated to hear that he was never actually seriously considered Viserys' heir.
Right.
And so, like, I feel like they're trying. I feel like just making a lot of assumptions here about their choices in the writer's room, but it feels like Ryan Condal heard that. And then it was like, okay, how do we work that? How do we make this matter to at least some characters? And it's like, it's certainly being put there for Rhaenyra to feel very strongly that she needs to fight for the Iron Throne because she has this like burden on her. It was also sort of there when she had to like turn away Kristen, and she like started to try to tell him about this prophecy, but he didn't want to hear it, and now he hates her forever because he thinks that she just like didn't.
Do you think she would have told him about that if he would have shut up for a minute?
I think that's where she was going when he was like, Aegon set me on a path, or like set the Targaryens on a path, and like we can't. And like, I think that she was getting at like this idea that I can't run away to Essos because I have this duty.
Do you think that this is something that like Viserys would tell? I'm now wondering, like, I'm fascinated by like, if you've got a 16-year-old girl who's got the secret, does she tell like multiple people? Did Viserys tell Aemma or Emma? Did Jaehaerys never tell Allison, his wife, you know, good Queen Alice? Like, what, how closely, because that's the thing. It's like, it seems crazy to me that you'd have a king who would wait, like when you said he's made officially heir, like on the eve of his ascension, or like, it seems crazy that Targaryens who could die at any time because they're poisoned, or there's war, or their dragon mishap, and this could be snuffed out at any time, that you wouldn't. Like, it kind of blew my mind that they didn't tell Daemon.
And then that's why I'm like, and then they did the One Ring secret Mordor text on the knife, because like then the knife is there.
There's a way to get testimony.
There's physical evidence that this prophecy exists. And if someone can just read that old Valyrian, then they would figure it out.
And clearly, in the canon, it, I think there's people already is like there's a cottage industry of like identifying the this prophecy submerging and reemerging because like it gets lost. All by all accounts, like Rhaegar rediscovered it for the first time since maybe like Summerhall. So you got that element that's kind of cool too, that like it can't quite be killed because there's enough lore written. There's the blade. There's like the people will independently rediscover it.
Yeah. And I think in general, I feel like some of the adaptation changes that they've made, while some of them I think were like leaning a little bit too much on just misunderstanding alone, but it's like even that, even all the misunderstandings, I feel like they're just really piling on to the tragedy of it all. Mm. And so like the fact that this prophecy, which we the audience knows, is at least partially correct in that this threat from the north is going to come and threaten to kill out all of humanity in Westeros, that might have been lost because this civil war happened. Like, right? Like, yeah. This is partially why the Targaryen dynasty starts to decline, because this key motivator for them ruling in the way that they were gets snuffed out because no one tells enough people, or because Rhaenyra dies before she can pass it on to Jace or whatever, or yeah. That it's like a secret lost to time, and we're kind of getting to watch people flub it. But there, I think that there is a limit to how entertaining that is if you're not also giving us like, I don't know, more context. And then yeah, there's all the arguments about like whether or not the prophecy even came true,
or whether the Targaryens ever did. Is that something that like I always analogize that my mom's always talking about how important it is to keep the house clean. But given her chance on a weekend, she'd rather chill and not clean up the house than, you know, it's kind of like when us kids had a messy room, it's like, you got to keep the house clean. But when the dishes haven't been done since like Friday night and it's Sunday, you know, it's like the Targaryens are all about this prophecy when they're trying to justify to themselves about why they're on top. But when they're in their day to day governing, it's nowhere near their priority. It feels like a little bit of hypocrisy.
Because people brought up like, why would the wall have fallen into such decline over the years? Which I guess like they haven't shown us the wall at all, and they've only mentioned it a couple of times, maybe only once in House of the Dragon.
It's not on anyone's radar, it doesn't seem.
But it's like, okay, maybe it's fine for now because Viserys was making sure it was well protected during his reign and we just didn't see that. And now it's about to like really fall into disrepair.
Or maybe they think they're literally like the realm security blanket. As long as they're kind of like, you know, as long as there's a Stark in Winterfell, as long as there's a Targaryen on the Iron Throne, like that's just some kind of magical defense against.
Yeah.
And that's the important
thing.
That means
we can save everybody. If we need to.
Yeah, because if you're prophesied to do something, it doesn't matter how strong the wall is, you're prophesied to do it. So, like, it'll work out regardless. We talked about whether the prophecy is true, and we had a mutual fan who I noticed that's something that David was mentioning, that he felt like by his lights, the Song of Ice and Fire prophecy did not even literally come true on the main series. And we had a mutual fan, Latanya, who didn't get this in by your rap podcast, so she heard that you're going to be on our show, so this is the second attempt. She wanted to say, from Dave's perspective, why doesn't he think the prophecy is fulfilled? She says, the realm was united against the threat in the north. The prophecy doesn't specifically say the prince who was promised had to sit on the Iron Throne. It doesn't say the king or queen who was promised. Prophecies are very fickle, and their interpretation is not always clear. The prophecy says, from my blood comes the prince that was promised, and his will be the Song of Ice and Fire. It doesn't say a Targaryen must sit the Iron Throne, even though that's how it is interpreted. Both Daenerys and Jon are Targaryens and descendants of Rhaenyra. Couldn't it be possible that prophecy was fulfilled, just not in the way that everyone thought? Does it really matter if Dany or Jon was the prince who was promised? Dany and Jon both worked together to unite the realm against the White Walkers. Could Jon be the ice and Dany be the fire? I mean, that's like the conventional... That's like this on the face of it, how I think most people interpret it, right? Neither one of them are sitting on the Iron Throne, but they were Targaryens uniting the realm against, for better or worse, against the threat of the White Walkers.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, too, because, like, I don't know if that, I don't think that they made it clear that like that dagger is word for word what Aegon's prophecy was, or if it's just like the flowery summary of it. Mm-hmm. But like when Viserys is communicating the prophecy to Rhaenyra, he does specify that like, what I have the quote again. It says, just as Daenerys foresaw the end of Valyria, Aegon foresaw the end of the world of men. 'Tis to begin with a terrible winter gusting out of the distant north. Aegon saw absolute darkness riding on those winds, and whatever dwells within will destroy the world of the living. When this great winter comes, all of Westeros must stand against it. And if the world of men is to survive, a Targaryen must be seated on the Iron Throne. Mm. A king or queen strong enough to unite the realm against the cold and dark. Aegon called his dream a song of ice and fire. So, like,
do you think those statements? I guess
I think some of what Latonya was saying is we have conflicting accounts within House of Dragon, because it does actually, like, Viserys made a point to say that someone has to be sitting on the Iron Throne, and we know for sure that in the show's canon, Cersei was on the Iron Throne when this happened. My thing is like, I agree that like, I think in this email, like she said, like maybe it did, maybe it didn't. Maybe we just don't like how it happened in the show. And I'm like, yeah, I think how it happened in the show is not George's idea of how that threat is going to be resolved.
Yeah.
And so I think in the show's version of events, we got a very imperfect fulfillment of the prophecy. Like, yes, totally correct that Jon and Dany did unite a good amount of the realm. Mm-hmm. Not all of the realm.
Not all like, of it, sure.
Not all of it. They were pivotal in like holding off the White Walkers and Night King for as long as they could, but really everybody was about to die if Arya hadn't pulled out that dagger trick. Jon was literally like hiding from a dragon right before all of this happened. You know, like the show made it made Arya like such a key pivotal reason for the defeat of the Night King, who doesn't even exist in the books himself. The whole mechanism by which I know the whole mechanism of the White Walkers and that stuff, we aren't sure how accurate that is to like George's understanding of how that threat is going to happen. And like Benioff and Weiss, I think it was Benioff, said in one of those after the episodes, like, oh, we landed on Arya because we thought that was going to be the most surprising choice to take out the Night King. I could say a lot of words about that approach, but like to me that reads, oh, Arya doesn't have some big part to play in this like prophecy and all of these fan theories. That was simply a show invention of like, how can we most catch fans off guard with who they think is going to land that final blow. Like, again, I'm back in this like murky space of like, I just don't think that we have all the answers. We don't have all the information yet about what George meant by telling Ryan Condal this prophecy. What are George's ideas for how he's going to like resolve his own prophecy? I totally agree that George never writes prophecies straight black or white in their fulfillment or anything. Like the whole point is that they can be very fickle. And also, sorry, this might be a tangent. Tell me if this is completely boring.
Please, tange away.
Have you read either Song of Achilles or Cersei by Madeline Miller? Those two books. Have you heard of them?
No.
Okay. Well, 10 out of 10 recommend for both of them.
But
what Madeline Miller does with those books is retells Greek myth. And similar to what House of the Dragon is doing with Fire and Blood, kind of like corrects the narrative that certain people who just appeared as side characters in like Odysseus's story weren't actually like the pivotal emotional driver of what was going on. And in Greek myth specifically, and she outlines this in the book, is that like the fates dole out prophecies all the time, and then the gods will sometimes like tell those prophecies to various humans or demigods or whatever. And every prophecy is designed to like be basically as cruel and like unpredictably fulfilled as possible. Of like,
it's all very monkey paw,
right? Like, you're not gonna understand exactly what this means until the last minute, and then you're gonna see exactly what it cost you to have that good thing happen to you or whatever. And as I was watching House of Dragon, I just kept thinking about like her approach to retelling myth and what House of the Dragon is doing. And I think that like they might be trying to get at some of that, but we're just so far away from knowing how George plans on addressing Rhaegar's discovery of the prince that was promised theory and why that matters for Jon Snow existing. And all of these things that the show just didn't have, that Benioff and Weiss were not prioritizing in terms of their storytelling by the end there. So it's really hard for me to, like, again, stand definitively and, like, yes, it was fulfilled, but imperfectly, or no, it was all horseshit, because it's just like, we're dealing with so many separate canons here.
Right.
And murkiness. So I think that that's probably why on the podcast, I was like, we're just going to skip the deep prophecy questions. Cause like, if you're only a show watcher, it's so hard to grasp like where they're going with all of those details, or what was right and what was wrong, or what was a show only thing, or what was a book only thing. But Latanya definitely has good points in there about, like, there were elements of it that are true. And yes, it doesn't always, even if you try to interpret the prophecy as literally as possible, there are going to be blind spots in.
Especially, I noticed when you were reading that quote, it's like, we also don't know how much of that was the real prophecy, how much of that was Viserys' editorializing. Because when he says, like, a Targaryen must be on the Iron Throne, comma, we must have a king or queen strong enough to unite the realm. Are those both the same thing, or you just need
Are those mutually exclusive?
Because
conditions?
If this Iron Throne is just like, well, we have to have a Targaryen king, and I can't imagine an environment where there'd be a Targaryen king and they wouldn't be on the Iron Throne. Or is that something that Aegon actually said? No, because like before Aegon did the conquest, there wasn't an Iron Throne to sit. So did he make the Iron Throne to fulfill that? So it's like, I'm like, we don't.
Right. Or, like, does Jon being crowned king in the North qualify as being a Targaryen king who is leading the effort to defeat?
And Dany was crowned queen as well, true. So you had both of them, yeah.
Yes. So,
but there's also a lot of, I always thought that the dragon had three heads, that there was going to be something, there was going to be a triumvirate, like there was a lot of this stuff that, like, the double D's just had no interest in exploring towards the end. They're just like, gotta get on to the Star Wars sequels, the trilogy.
So I think by that, having talked through all of that, that's, I think, one of the reasons why I'm not being too harsh on all the prophecy inclusions yet in House of the Dragon, because I'm waiting to see how much they actually incorporate that into the continuing narrative, right? Because either they're going to drop it, like, now and just be like, well, Civil War time, no time for prophecy madness, or somehow continue to expound upon why it's important that they had to mention this, aside from just having, like you said, some Game of Thrones cinematic universe connection between all the shows, which is very possible and would be not as cool in my
opinion. It's a little like Infinity Stones without like building up to an end game. Maybe there's still lots of hot D to talk about. We'll be back right after the break.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of King's Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
And now, back to Hot D. All right, so having said all that about the prophecy and, you know, our thoughts about George finishing the books, this is something that gets called, asked medium frequency on our podcast, and my co-host Jim just always shuts it down. He is, King Jim Harris is not interested in hearing any of this heresy. How would you feel if they rebooted Game of Thrones, the series, in the next decade or so?
Deck feels too soon.
So that'd be 20 years on from the original series premiere.
Yeah, but only like 5 years on from the, like, they would have to be, they would have to have that in development like 5 years from now. And I think that they're still going to be in full successor.
Let's say 15, 20 then. Because I thought decade was sufficient, was like a sufficiently impressive book, a block of time, but.
How would I feel? I think I would feel similar to the House of the Dragon announcement of being like, no idea what to expect from that.
So you'd reserve judgment.
I would probably reserve judgment. I feel like Harry Potter's got to go first.
I said the same damn thing in the last podcast. I'm like, if you think this is nuts, even though you pretty much can't do a better job than they already did, I know that in my lifetime they'll reboot Harry Potter. Are they actually doing that?
No, I don't know, but I'm saying of course someone will, like,
because there's money to be made. Sure,
there's money to be made. Also, I did not like those movies, and I there's a lot of feelings that I have about Harry Potter these days anyways,
well,
because of phobia.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know. I think that some other franchise is going to go first before HBO would try
Let me ask you this. What if George, do you, are, if I told you that this is George after finishing the books, are you more or less excited?
More, for sure.
Yeah. What if do you think HBO could get away with just rebooting like seasons 6, 7, and 8? Like,
no,
you really don't think that you could? You don't think you could recast it and just, because like I think for my money, I don't know that you can do it better. I mean, I have quibbles with individual decisions, but I don't know you can do better
in the
seasons 1 through 4 of Game of Thrones. Like, they pretty much nail it. Season 5, I have a little bit with the Dorne because I think what George is going to do is going to involve more of the Martells and all that stuff. But like, you get into 7 and 8 and they're clearly pretty off the beaten path. And I just wonder if you get, you know, you just nail the casting. Cause look at what they did with like the Star Trek movies. Everyone was pretty happy with that being recast. You know, they do it regularly with James Bond, Batman, the Batman, the Spider-Man. I don't know why people are so resistant, because I think that's a great idea to, it's so expensive to do the whole thing. But if George finishes the books, if I think there'd be sufficient interest that you could do something like that.
Yeah. Or like a movie trilogy.
Or you get the original like cast George back and you do Uncanny Valley, CGI de-aging. So like Maisie's still running around like she's 16 and,
I mean, it's not that I personally would hate it. I think it's just that I don't see HBO backtracking to the point of being like, oh yeah, all those times that we said that we were definitely just like super happy and very proud and like think that.
Well, that's what the books coming out would give him cover. Yes. Yeah, they couldn't just see like, this is actually shit. We got to redo it.
I wouldn't want them to cave to the petitions to reshoot the fight. Like, you know, I don't think
I'm pro caving.
I don't know, but I do think that it is likely to happen in my lifetime. Same way that, like, you know, there were so many little Lord of the Rings iterations before the Peter Jackson movie.
Sure.
And then those became the defining adaptation for a whole generation of people.
Right.
It seems likely that in the future there will be a new generation of people who have a new version of some sort of Westerosi based or some sort of A Song of Ice and Fire based adaptation on the table.
If they were going to redo just individual seasons, like, and you had your druthers, where would you pick as a launching point? Which was the last pure season? What's the last pure George Blood season?
I would say 4, but even then the wheels were starting to come off a little bit at the end there for me.
Wow. 4. Cause I thought 4, what was the real wheel spinning off on 4?
It was the whole Tyrion.
Did they burn Shireen?
No, that was 5.
Okay.
For whatever reason got under my skin a little bit was changing Tyrion's, like Tyrion murdering Shay, even though like, I don't know, that was all messy. And then he didn't fight with Jaime when they like left, like the separation of Tyrion and Jaime being amicable and nice instead of like, by the way, I killed your son, and by the way, Cersei's fucking moon boy and all these other people, like all of that,
so that he ruminates over that the next
Jaime's ruminating over that, and that's why he's leaving Cersei, and then Tyrion feels
he's ruminating over
too, forever. And he decided to let people continue loving those characters the way that they were, mm-hmm. in a way that to me pivotally would have ripple effects out through the rest of the seasons. I would probably, and same reasons, like I think that there could be a whole Dorne redo, a Lady Stoneheart reveal. Like if they really wanted to reboot it and like set a different canon course, you know, kick us off with a cold open of Lady Stoneheart and like really show it, like really lean into all
you need
the magic.
Something you would need a banger like intro to like really suck people in. That'd be an excellent one. Yeah.
Hire me.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I like your instincts. It's time for a woman to show run a Game of Thrones property. Let's get Kim in there.
When I'm what, like 48 years old, you can hire somebody.
All right, I want to keep it leal for the audience. I'm about to get spoilery with Kim here. This is stuff that like only book read. This is book reader shit. This is us making some inferences based on our foreknowledge of what's going on. If you want to remain completely unsullied, I highly recommend you hit stop right now. As a jumping off point, Kim, where can they find you around the internet if they don't want to join us past the spoiler barricade?
Yeah, I'm still lurking on Twitter these days at Kim R. Renfro. See how long.
Shaky. Lasts. Standing on shaky ground, Kim. We're all standing on shaky ground.
I'm tweeting out as many pleasant cat videos and
I saw David Chin is packing up the tent and heading into the sunset for a newsletter. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah. And you can always find my writings on insider.com.
What are you covering in the immediate future that people are probably going to be excited about?
You'll love this. I'm trying to get in on the 1899.
Us too. Train. We're going to be doing like two episodes a day from the day of the release until we're finished. So
fun.
Yeah.
I haven't got screeners yet or anything, but that should be.
We never will because we never get them from Netflix and people have been hating us on screeners lately. So I don't know. We must have pissed off a PR person at some point, but we will persevere. I'm really curious about 1899 and really excited to see what happens to that. But got to finish on Hot D here. Laenor Valerian. There's theories because that was one of the more shocking, you know, like jaw drop moments on the show. Is like, oh, he's not dead. Actually, they really faked me out. Have you heard any of the alternate Laenor truth or theories?
No, lay them on me.
Okay. The most popular one is that there's this character called Adam Hull, who is a Valerian bastard that has silver hair and purple eyes. You know, Daemon at the end of this season laid out the dragon inventory and said there's a whole bunch of dragons that don't have riders. Maybe some of them never had riders. We need to, you know, implying that we need to find people to ride these dragons because otherwise these are bombs that don't have any guidance systems. They are going to be a call, I imagine, early next season where they're going to put out like the call to like anyone, you know, so you think you can ride a dragon, come out here and prove it. And if you don't get burnt to death, you too can have a shiny, you know, 031 AC dragon. Mm-hmm. One of the guys that steps forward is Adam Hull. He's this bastard. He's got silver hair, purple eyes. His mother says that she's a shipwright that works out of the Driftmark shipyards, says that Laenor is this person's father and he's a 15-year-old kid. He looks just like a Valerian. He's got dragon riding blood and he's able to swing his leg over sea smoke pretty easily because sea smoke at this time had already burnt, I think, at least one, maybe two other suitor riders to death. And Adam does not get burnt to death. He's then legitimized by his grandfather, Corlys, who says for his service as a dragon rider, we should make him full on. He becomes Adam Valerian. A lot of people are like, you know, it'd be a lot cleaner if Laenor just comes back as Adam Valerian. And that's the whole, like, you know, the bring him back gracefully so no one gets implicated and all the old skeletons remain buried. He's introduced as a Valerian bastard. And wink, wink, he's actually Corlys' son, but he's actually Laenor's son. Like, do you think that would work on the show?
I don't know. There's probably a way to do it that feels satisfying, but that would be a tricky line to toe. Because they're gonna, I'm like, then how are you gonna explain? Are you going to keep him in disguise? Just have him wear a helmet the whole time that he's riding sea smoke and like not let everybody know that his death was actually fake? Like, I feel like that would raise too many questions from too many people in the story.
But if you claim that it's his son or if it's Corlys' son, then him looking just like Laenor is pretty easy to explain because, like, you know, I've seen siblings that are not twins that look, there's a strong family resemblance, you know, like if it's been a couple of years since I've seen him and it's a medieval setting where I don't have a digital picture of him, like, oh shit, it's a spitting image.
Yeah.
But not suspiciously so.
Yeah. Or like, I mean, you can also just make the case that, like, everybody on Team Rhaenyra would be happy to know that Laenor's alive and probably, like, you know, he could quickly explain, like, well, I was under direct threat the longer that people accused her children of being bastards and, like, whatever, whatever, and I had to get out of there while my name was hot. And now all the people who give a shit about me being gay or not actually being the father of these children are definitely our enemies.
Enemies of the state.
So who cares what they think? And, like, I can just be back and be alive and they can deal with it. Or never see me, because, like you said, it's not like he's posting Twitter updates in Westeros being like, back home for the holidays. Like, how would anyone know that he's around?
I do like it. So, there's something, because they his mom and dad keep on talking about how they're supporting Rhaenyra in spite of, you know, the fact that, you know, it's like for the grandkids. I think there is something of, like, a faith rewarded. Like, I could see it being very emotional, that especially if they could figure they could fudge the timeline a little bit and bring it back to where, you know, Rhaenys and Corlys and them are still alive to appreciate it. And, like, oh, you know, Rhaenyra was actually true blue this whole time. And then establish. Yeah, I think it would be cool. It's a cool theory. And it's also because otherwise I'm not exactly sure why they deviated from the book canon, because on the surface it's like, oh, you know, Rhaenyra didn't murder this guy, didn't have him murdered. But, like, I don't know. Everyone thinks they did, and they like the idea that everyone thinks they did. And they also murdered, like, an innocent footman. So it's like, I never thought that was, like, a real gentling of, like, Rhaenyra and Daemon. And other thing is, like, it doesn't happen that way in the books at all. Like, I don't think there's a clear implication of, like, Daemon and Rhaenyra had this guy killed for their convenience or whatever.
Yeah, I think, like the prophecy, it feels like one tiny of many tiny leanings on the scale of, like, does Rhaenyra have the most just claim to the throne? And it's like, yeah, because not only is she the one who knows this prophecy, and the reason why she knows it is because she was the named heir, not Aegon, but, like, oh, we, the audience, also think that she's a slightly better person for having figured out a way to save her husband instead of discarding him or murdering him or leaving him exposed to all of these, like, rumors and drama. But I don't know. I can also see them just bringing in a bastard teen and, like, having him become one of the gang with all the rest of the
bastard
kids.
Adam.
And, like,
It's like, I think that's still more plausible, but it is intriguing to find a way to bring this guy back.
And to explain why, like, I think that was a question that a lot of show only people had, especially because Laenor's, that surprise came after Vhagar was claimed. And, like, you had this sense that, like, you can't claim someone else's dragon if they're still alive. So, like, how is Sea Smoke ever going to have another rider?
That's,
or is
a
Sea
bit,
Smoke
well,
just
that's
be
the
gone?
Other. I thank you for mentioning it, because that's the other big strong leg of this theory is, like, well, if they're bonded for life and Sea Smoke, and that's, we see this as a psychic bond over distance, you know, then how the hell is Sea Smoke ever going to allow anyone to ride him?
Right.
So, like, him coming back, you know, as wink, wink, Adam Hall would be a way to, you know, navigate that, I guess.
Yeah.
Here's a hot take. I don't know what they're going to do with this in the future. And I appreciate what you said about, you know, Rhaenyra not actually killing her husband. We get a lot, you know, this green and black thing is a real situation. It's like a fucking street gang out there. Like, people, have you not seen this? Like, people are, like, taking it really freaking serious. And I feel like the greens are kind of hurt somewhat by what it feels like that the show is really putting a thumb on the scales for Team Black. I feel like Rhaenyra and Daemon just straight up murder Laenor. The fandom's a little bit more evenly split about Team Black versus Team Green, because that's such a cold Machiavellian move, and it kind of like directly stains both Daemon and Rhaenyra as their stock is at an all-time high. I feel like the show might have been better to have them do something that dastardly and cold-blooded just to kind of balance the spite that the audience is giving towards one side or the other. If they want to do, I mean, I don't know if that's important to them, but.
Yeah, I mean, I generally am disinterested in, like, just because you're rooting more for one person doesn't mean that you have to, like, actively hate the other side.
Agreed.
Like, I feel like the people who are Team Green, like, cool, have a blast watching them be weirdos. Like, there are a lot of interesting, compelling characters on that side. Uh-huh. And like Helena not included. That was one more theory that I was going to bring up, a like future potential spoiler theory.
Well, we're still in the zone. What? Yeah, bring it up. Yeah.
The Aemond and Helena, that Jaehaerys and Jaehaera are actually Aemond's children, not Aegon's.
Really?
Because Aemond and Helena are like having some sort of side secret, genuine love connection among themselves, while Aegon is just like their shitty brother. I kind of buy that as like,
and your evidence of this is him being willing to do the royal duty towards his sister, and that, or is it just a, I like that, it.
It's that, it's the way that he like was in her room and seemed very comfortable. And like protective of her in a way that Aegon is not, once they jump forward a little bit in age, and like the whole crowning ceremony, the way that Helena was like, seemed very upset by like the fact that this was happening to Aegon, but was like very closely, she was just like standing super close to her brother and like looking. I don't know. I'd believe it.
But was Aemond in her room because he's, or was he just there because that's where everyone assumed Aegon would be? And he was like, wanting...
Yeah, I think he was just trying to like join the party, but like,
gotcha. Okay. All right.
I don't know. There have been some glances, and the show seems to be heavily leaning into
Kim
body
is
language
rooting for more days. Incest in Hot D. There's not enough. She's got to get more.
I'm rooting for Helena to have at least one man in her life.
Okay.
Treating her nicely.
I can definitely get behind that. Okay, well, that's, I think that's, do you think the beast under the boards is that Meleys, and Rhaenys, or, because I still think still it was interesting. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, blood and cheese.
Right. That's the,
name?
Yep. That's the second most popular theory. I thought it was, well, the thing I was thinking that it might have been Aemond, because I thought it was really interesting how when she had her last freak out about the beast beneath the boards, like she says that and then they smash cut to Aemond walking in the room.
Mm.
And it's like sometimes they make those visual connections between dialogue and characters, but then you have a big dragon bust out of the floor at the end of that episode. Maybe that is the actual fulfillment. Because I did a rundown of like, you know, why I didn't like some theories. Blood and cheese makes a little bit of sense. I do not like the idea of who's the bastard, Aegon's bastard, the pale hair.
Yeah.
I don't like that because that kid's not a
ring.
Yeah, that kid's not really a monster. Like even how he develops in the book, like he's essentially made a false king by his two mothers that live in a brothel, and he just issues these gentle proclamations like men and women should be treated as equals and sellswords should be taken care of by their lords when they're wounded. And it's like, I mean, I guess he's a pretender to the throne, but he's like five and nothing really comes of it.
I think the reason why I'm leaning a little bit more towards that, like, yes, it might have already been resolved with Rhaenys, but I think that we're going to get the like double whammy with blood and cheese is the fact that she, like, when she says it that second time to Alicent and the way that Alicent responds, it's been a tick, like she's been saying this over and over again with like increasing distress, but Alicent just like doesn't know what she's talking about. It's just like, yes honey, I know, like calm down. And I think that her being in distress over that makes a lot more sense in connection to what's going to happen in that room, right? Because presumably they're going to come up from the boards in her bedroom, which is where she was when she said that.
Right.
And like, and then the twins are sitting right there when she says it.
Yeah, so that's true too.
It's like they gave show watchers a like, oh yeah, it was the dragon later in this episode. How cool. And then like, it's going to be like, oh shit.
Yeah.
Maybe this was actually a lot darker.
I will be on DEFCON 5 if next season she comes back and is still muttering about the beast beneath the boards. That will be like, oh, shit.
For sure.
Yeah. Well, again, if you want to follow Kim, we'll have all the links to her socials and to her bylines in the show notes of this here podcast. So if you missed them the first two times they gave them out, they're there. I am excited to see what you make of 1899. Because I was under the mistaken impression until just like last week that it was a direct prequel to Dark, where it's like there may be connections, but this is a completely separate work.
Yeah. Because of the after crossovers and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought because like I was thinking like 18 is like, is that like a on the year cycle from the and it turns out that was all crap and I was wrong. But I am excited because like Dark was uniquely consuming from like a mental puzzle box time travel type of thing. And it's just like really a complicated story to tell that they did extremely well. So, yeah, they got some other kind of pseudo mystery
sci-fi
weird portals opening kind of thing, and I'm in for it.
I think it's a is it not a like Bermuda Triangle thing
or was does, that I really think, off base? I don't know they're going across the Atlantic Ocean. The Bermuda Triangle is there somewhere. It's in my but like is it's Miami, Bermuda, Panama, like isn't it that try like it's essentially the Gulf. You just stay the hell away out of the Gulf of Mexico. That's just good advice. Just don't go there.
I trust their ability to do really cool puzzle boxy sci-fi magic storytelling. So 100%. I'm just on board to see whatever they have conceived of for this new version.
So if it's been in your noodle, I highly recommend checking out Kim's coverage on that, because like you did amazing work on Dark. So you were the foremost Darkian expert on the internet.
Someone
had to do it. Might as well be you.
I gladly put my sword forward.
Well, thanks for coming on. Always a pleasure, Kim. We'll see you hopefully sometime soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me.